This episode is brought to you in part by Dr. Tony Evans, author of Kingdom Kindness. Learn how to become a countercultural force by reflecting God's kindness. Find this and other uplifting resources on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold.
This is CT Media.
Well, folks, welcome to Being Human. My name's Steve Cuss. Really glad to be with you today. Today, I'm really excited about this episode because I have a guest who's also a friend of mine named Jeff Hanen. Jeff's the founder of the Denver Faith and Work Institute, which started out as a local organization here in Denver where I live, really helping equip people to integrate their faith into their work. I'll just say, as a pastor, I never felt like I did that very well for my people. I always felt kind of guilty about it. Like, people come to church on Sunday. Am I really equipping them to navigate the 40 to 60 hours of work? I think one thing I did do well as I reflect on it is when we did our service to the city, I really did activate our caregivers, our occupational therapists, our social workers, our therapists in the congregation. We really did have a pretty specialized army at our church. I learned that a lot of people, they really want their faith to make a difference in the kingdom. That's one of the reasons I'm so excited to introduce you to Jeff. His book that just came out is Working from the Inside Out, fantastic book on faith in the workplace. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Before we get to Jeff, I just want to pause and light our candle. And I want to light this candle just in honor of those of you who have difficult work environments. Maybe you've got a tough boss. Maybe you've got a job that you love, but it's just really hard. Just the nature of the work you do is hard, or it costs you. And the candle, especially a reminder that God is not just with us in the workplace. God goes ahead of us in our workplace. So when we show up to work, those of us who roll up to an office, God's already there. That's been such a helpful reminder to me when I'm anxious, is that I can just pause. Maybe when I park my car, and as I'm walking into that building, maybe I'm going into a difficult meeting, or maybe something that's just intense. I can just pause for a moment and just remember God's already here. I'm not bringing God with me. I'm not on my own. I'm actually relaxing into God's presence. So hopefully that's helpful for you today. I really enjoyed chatting to Jeff. He's become a friend over the years. So it was two friends chatting, but I began just right out of the gate by asking him, what's the best way to fire somebody?
Loudly and with fury. It's just what everybody loves. Everybody wants to be really embarrassed after. Okay, actually, the best way to fire somebody is, first of all, there should never be a surprise. And so I hope you've had some conversations about performance and giving them good, clear, and honest feedback and haven't avoided conflict until it blows up. So I would say, first say that. First, be clear about expectations that haven't been met and that you've given various different opportunities for growth. And then second, I would also say it's about their job performance and not about their intrinsic character, about who they are. Your job performance is not a fit here. And you can still affirm a core of anybody that you're firing in terms of their intrinsic worth and value and their professional talents. And you can send them off with a severance package if you're able to do it in a way that honors their intrinsic dignity. So I'd say those things.
Yeah. Have you run into managers that they tolerate bad behavior so long because they don't know how to confront clearly, and then it kind of boils up and they explode on the employee? Have you ever seen that before?
Oh, totally. Those relational tendencies happen everywhere. They can happen in families, with parents, with siblings. They can happen with the managers and employees as well. And when those things happen, that's on the manager. That is just not the employee's fault. If you cannot be open about conflict and do that in a healthy way, that's the internal work that a manager needs to do to start building some of those muscles. Absolutely.
Man, in some ways, I think the besetting sin of my leadership has been believing that people will do the right thing if I just leave them alone. And then when I finally have to confront them, I usually have to apologize. Like, hey, there's two problems here. One problem is your behavior, but the bigger problem is how long I let you get away with it.
Yeah, and that takes an amount of humility to say, I should have said something about this months ago, but I felt afraid. I felt like I didn't want conflict, which is a failure of leadership.
Yeah, for sure. All right, why don't we flip the coin on the other way? What's the best way to ask for a raise or a promotion?
I think if possible, ask for it at the beginning of a job, of getting hired. People oftentimes think they're not worth it, but generally speaking, if people ask for something, companies will reciprocate with, oh, that person really is that valuable. So I'd say be bold enough on the front end of a job to ask for what you think you're worth and maybe even a little bit more. It's not necessarily a greedy thing. Everybody knows that you're caring for your family and for others. Second, say you are in a job and you want to get a raise, I think you can go in the front door saying, look at my performance in the last year or two and how much value I've contributed to this company. Now, some people can monetize that. If you're a kindergarten teacher or something, it's a little harder to monetize it. But you can absolutely say, I've built this culture, I've performed well, and I would like to have a raise. Not every company can do it, but I actually think connecting it to performance and value creation can be a second great way to ask for a raise.
Yeah. All right. So I've come out of the gate asking questions about behaviors, but actually your book, it's really about the internal life of a person at work. You give us, Jeff, five principles: seek deep spiritual health, think theologically, embrace relationships, create good work, serve others sacrificially. That's the five. I find it fascinating that the first two principles you uncover really are about our faith. Tell us a bit about that.
My career for the last 10 years has been really thinking about how do people live out their faith in their work. In my journey, and when I looked at other people's journeys too, we look at scriptures and work can be good. It can be a part of Genesis 1 and 2 and what God is calling us to the world. And it can have tremendous exterior impact when we think about the ways we can serve the social needs of our day and care for our neighbors, and work should be that. The challenge I found with my own work and with others is that if they hadn't done the interior work, those external changes didn't last very long. It could be, I want a really healthy culture and I'm going to put these values on there, but I haven't dealt with things. It just doesn't work. Or we're going to make a big dent in injustice in our community, and yet they're transferring toxic relationships or treating people very poorly. And oftentimes when I started to just pay attention to people, thinking, huh, there's something inside them that's causing those pain. Then coming back in my own life, that was exactly the problem with my own leadership, is that I actually hadn't done a lot of the interior work. I'm entrepreneurial by nature, so I have a lot of ideas, but I realize oftentimes I just roughshod over people, not really caring about what they think, and just saying, well, get at it. Come on, let's move it forward. It just, I could be very, I'd say, insensitive, move quickly, those types of things. And I had a couple of teammates that were very kind, but really helped me grow in this area. And I realized that if I really wanted to live out my faith through my work, yes, we need to create good work. Yes, we need to embrace relationships and then eventually move to that civic life, which is serve others sacrificially. But first I had to do this, seek deep spiritual health. And then I need to think about myself and my work inside the biblical story as well. So the main idea of the book is before you do the exterior impact, do the interior work. The impact will be much more enduring and more holistic.
Yeah. So in Working from the Inside Out, you really take us on a journey of this. But for somebody just who's watching this podcast or listening to it, maybe they really want to make a difference in the workplace, but they don't have any theological training. Where might they begin to think theologically about their work?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I wrote the book for lay people like myself. So I do think actually the book is a good start. You can take a look at the basics of the biblical story and put your work in light of those and start to understand what that looks like. So for example, in the Reformed tradition, we'll oftentimes talk about creation, fall, redemption, and consummation, a shorthand for the biblical story. In your workplace, you can ask basic questions like, creation, what about my work or my company or the culture is really good that I can get behind? These are goods and services that are genuinely meeting human needs, right? You can second ask about the fall. You can think, what is really broken about my industry, about my company, about the culture, about my team, about me? You can honestly ask about the fall and look at that. the consummation, you can actually say, what would it look like in my workplace or in my company if these things were healed? And this is a work of the imagination, because the Bible is not directly talking to finance or some of the structures that we have in our culture today. But you could actually imagine with your heart and with your mind, what would it look like if these were healed, if this was different? And the redemption aspect is really, okay, at the end of the day, what am I called to do about this? Because I can't fix everything. I'm not the CEO. I'm not maybe the board that can change everything. But you do have agency and you can do something. So where do I feel the Holy Spirit summoning me in this moment to start to heal what's gone wrong? So that's just one way to think theologically about just applying basic structures of the biblical story to your own work and thinking, where do I find myself in God's redemptive story right here, right now?
Okay, so the book you wrote was born out of this organization you founded and led for years, the Denver Faith and Work Institute. I don't know many organizations like it around the world. I know there's probably more forming. I know Redeemer Church in New York City has a Faith and Work output, but just tell us about the early years, what you were hoping to accomplish when you first started Denver Faith and Work.
Yeah. So when I started the organization back in 2012, I wanted to create this bridge between our church lives and what we're doing with the rest of our weeks, not only in our work life, but in our city, because cities is just people going to work. That's what a city is mostly. And when you take a look at any urban area, and I just thought, we got to figure out what it looks like to be people of faith in these different areas. So at that time, I was reading some theologians that were really influential on me, guys like Leslie Newbegin, who is a British missionary, other theologians that gave me this idea of the West as a mission field. And if we want to send out missionaries into the mission field, we'll have to send them out into all these different areas of culture. So I would say that is one of the areas where I said there is this real gap. We can talk about that there's no such thing as the sacred secular divide. And I agree with that theologically, but when you look sociologically, there is a tremendous divide between people's religious life and where you can quote Jesus and where you can't. But like, this is, if you're just in a boardroom, you can quote Socrates, but not Jesus. There's something there, right? Even with ancient wisdom teachers, right? So I think there is still a need for that. And I also say there are other organizations. My organization is a local one focused in the Denver area. There's other similar institutes. You mentioned one in New York, the Center for Faith and Work. There is one in Nashville Institute for Faith and Work, a Charlotte Institute for Faith and Work. There's now in Austin. We've helped with the network of these. And there's also organizations that are doing different kinds of, but similar work in this faith and work space, some particularly in business and finance. So it is a large space. And if your listeners haven't heard of this space too, you're forgiven. It can feel a little niche-y. I could never really describe my job to my aunt.
I'll never forget several years ago, one of my elders, just on a Sunday morning after church, I'd preached a couple of times and we're just chatting. And I said, okay, it's Sunday. What's going to happen Monday morning for you? And he said, oh man, I'm putting on my armor. He's like, it's challenging. I want to do good work. I'm often challenged to make ethically dubious decisions that I'm not willing to make with my faith. And he was just letting me in a little bit, Jeff, on the pressures he faces Monday through Friday in his job. And I just came away thinking, I really am not, as a pastor, I don't know how to equip people to think theologically about their work. I feel like I kind of failed in some ways in that. For pastors watching or listening to this, what would be one or two things, just simple things that they can do to really help their congregation feel seen and equipped for work on Monday?
Yeah, let me direct these comments directly to a pastor listening to this. I think there are way too many people in the faith at work movement, the world that I've been involved with, that have a little axe to grind with pastors. You didn't get this at your church, so we're going to help you do it over here. And it almost denigrates the life of the local church. And so I'm sorry on behalf of all those that have said that, because the work of a pastor is enormously difficult and beautiful and good. So I'll first say that. Second, there are good things to learn. One of the things I think is difficult for pastors is that when you take a look at work, first of all, there are so many different kinds of work. It's hard to know exactly what the heck people are doing every day. I mean, everything from architecture, engineer, to retail, to I got laid off. And then I think a lot of pastors will say, yeah, but I have a lot of students. And yeah, I have a lot of retired folks as well. And you don't want to alienate any one group. And so it makes it look like you're just talking to people that love their work. And so when that happens, not everybody does love their work. They feel like, ah, that didn't go over very well, or people didn't give me a high five. So I do think that's just very difficult with all the different demographics. I do think there are some really good areas to start. There are a lot of good books. There's a lot of good organizations that are really just focused on doing this for life of local church. So my friend leads a thing called the Made to Flourish Pastors Network. They're all about pastors doing a lot of this work in local congregations. The Reframe curriculum up in Regent. There's lots of different good things to just start. And I would say don't be too intimidated with getting it all right, but just start the conversation of, hey, you're going to live out majority of your daily life in family and work. Let's figure out what it means to be disciples of Jesus there. And just let those conversations happen. Let people share their varying perspectives.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And there does seem to be some differences between white-collar work and blue-collar work.
Yes.
And sometimes we focus on one to the detriment of the other. What's your thought on that?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I wrote an article for Christianity Today, actually years ago, called God of the Second Shift. And it was a cover story. The subtitle was, "The Faith at Work Movement is Missing Two-Thirds of All Workers." And that two-thirds of those that don't have four-year college degrees. So we distinguish between working class and professional, and that of a professional has a four-year college degree, two-thirds of workers don't have a college degree. I think it's a huge gap, and I think it's a huge miss. And there's historical reasons why this happened and how we got here, but we don't have to stay there. In the book, I put actually six different subsections of how professionals and working class folks may see their work differently. And they can be somewhat generalized. It's not true for everybody, but I could just give you one example. One little contrast would be real work versus networks. So professionals tend to manage social networks for management and connecting and sales. That tends to be a lot of the work of professionals. However, a lot of working class men and women, they do the real work. They are creating the physical world. They are cleaning. They are building. They're actually doing that work. And it's oftentimes this strange phenomenon of working class men and women know that their work is the literal foundation of our society. Like, how do you get clean water to your faucet every day, for instance? Who knows the process of that? So they both know that their work is fundamental, as well as they know that society doesn't esteem their work. And I think Christians should do that differently. So I do think there's some work we can be doing to say, if I have people coming from different professional backgrounds, working class backgrounds, family backgrounds, I wonder how they would approach this conversation. And I will say the majority of these faith work conversations in local churches are only assumed with professionals in mind. And it alienates the majority of people pretty quickly if you make some of those errors. Some of the church attendance numbers are declining in working class communities. And actually, they're staying pretty consistent for professional communities. So there's a lot of work to be done there.
In our broken world, it can be hard to see how Jesus is at work making all things new. That's why every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear through redemptive storytelling and global reporting. Whether it's a pastor in Brazil who uses CT in Portuguese to lead his ministry, or a young believer who wants to think biblically about our culture, CT comes alongside believers to illuminate what it looks like to follow Jesus in today's world. Jesus is transforming his world. CT is equipping his church. Give a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. As a part of that mission, Where You're From is a podcast for those who believe it's important to stop and listen before we speak. Join us on each episode as we ask another Christian thought leader where you're from and discover how their life experiences and expertise, even if we may disagree with something they say, offers us important perspectives worth thinking about. To see our list of guests, visit whereyourfrom.org today. That's whereyafrom.org. I'm Russell Berry, reminding you that it's not just about where you're at, but it's also about where you're from.
Last time we hung out socially, I was really struck by a passing comment you made about how Christians will go to another side of the world to help dig a well for clean water for the global poor, but we don't consider our own local water treatment plant team as people of dignity and essential and someone we're grateful for. We kind of take it for granted or we look down on that job.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. One of the contracts I'm working on right now is working for my dear friend Bob, and it's at a company called Treatment Technology, and we are a chemical distributor in the drinking water and wastewater treatment industries. And so when you flush water down the toilet, it needs to be treated before it goes back into the environment. And what's interesting, when you take a look at this, those communities, the water plant operators, they have a tremendous pride, a proper pride in their work. Jesus says, give me a glass of clean water and I won't forget it, right? Like they're giving glasses of waters to entire, like thousands, millions of people in the United States. Yet their life and their work is oftentimes not seen and not appreciated. So I just think there's a long ways to go to noticing the world as it is. Before I got into this industry, I didn't know anything about this industry, right? But if you're in an office building, you can do things like you appreciate the people that are cleaning and see them in the face and say, you're doing a good, honorable thing. You're loving your neighbors, yourself in this context. So I do think there's opportunities to talk and to listen about various different kinds of work that could bind our communities together rather than what we're seeing as a real polarizing of our communities.
Yeah. One of my biggest concerns about spiritual growth and discipleship in Western cultures is it feels like it's for the last 30, 50 years, it's been almost exclusively white collar. That's the way we have fundamentally practiced our faith is we think about things, we read the Bible, we think about it more. But when I think back to my blue collar work, I did an internship on a ranch for kids that would get in trouble. They'd come and live on this ranch. It was blue collar all the way. We milked cows, baled hay. I went to bed exhausted physically most days, best feeling in the world. And as a pastor, I was always convinced that church work and discipleship and volunteering is fundamentally blue collar. It's more about rolling up the sleeves and getting it done than it is about thinking about it. In fact, to be frank, I would usually be pretty suspicious of the white collar, particularly the white collar men that spent all week getting paid a lot of money to tell people what to do. They would sometimes bring that attitude into the church, thinking they were helping. What's your take on discipleship as it relates to blue collar and white collar mentality?
We got to pay attention and really learn from others. We really got to listen. So whether it's a dairy rancher or whether it's somebody cleaning hotel rooms, I mean, whatever it might be, I think we really have to listen to what is your life like? What is your experience of work? And what does it look like when you serve God on a day-to-day basis? It is interesting. I hang out in the communities of investors and entrepreneurs a lot. They're amazing folks and I love them. I don't see the same parallel communities in the United States of Christian construction workers. I don't see a lot of those large ones. Because what's interesting is the Catholic social movement was a proponent of unions for a long time and is actually based in Catholic social teaching and the dignity of work. Times have changed, and I just think that there needs to be a real rejuvenation of a proper noticing and appreciation of people's daily labor. I'd say that.
Yeah. In the book, you really point out that work is about sacrificial service. It's about embodying Jesus' command to love your neighbor. But I think for so many people, it really is about financial security, stability, providing, which is a good thing to do.
Totally.
But what are you seeing with the pressures and the financial pressures we're facing nowadays?
Yeah. So I think that is a huge issue for not only a lot of people in the United States, but my wife and I was not long ago, an unexpected $20 expense would cause incredible anxiety. Even for instance, if we were going out with some friends and they wanted to buy something and we felt like we had to match and we couldn't keep up, I actually think a lot of people feel that, especially in a wealthy culture when you're watching sitcoms and everybody has that kind of lifestyle and I got my thing here. I think it causes frustration, anxiety, sometimes a sense of shame, a need to keep up. You see these stats about a lot of people can't afford even a couple $100 expense in any given week. And that's a lot of folks out there as well. So I would say to work to provide for you and loved ones is intrinsically good and healthy. In professional communities, work is oftentimes about power, prestige, and identity in terms of sharing like how much impact you're making. If you don't find your identity in your work, that's fine. Actually, for Christians, I think finding your identity in Christ is where we actually have to refocus as well. So I would say that, and I would say there needs to be more work done from business leaders that find ways forward for good and just wages. I actually just put something on my LinkedIn about what is a good job and how business leaders can help create better jobs that allow more people to reach the middle class, that have benefits, that allow flexible yet stable schedules, because there are a lot of people that are struggling out there as well. So for those that are stuck in that, I would just say Jesus is with you. He was a laborer, and he did not die rich. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If an employee or a middle manager doesn't have much power in the workplace, there's several people above them, and they are feeling like their dignity is being stripped of them, they're being treated inhumanely, what are just a couple of options for them? Let's presume that they do have the option to leave and find other work. I understand that's not the case for everybody, but what would you coach them to do as their next moves?
Yeah, so first, I would say in that dignity piece, your dignity is given by God. No matter what somebody says or what somebody does to you, that is because you're an image bearer of God. And when you're in an environment that doesn't support that, it can be hard to believe, but it's still true. So I think that's an inner core of stability, where you know who you are and Christ has given you what you need. So I'll say that. Second, if somebody's treating you like that, like a boss in the workplace, humiliation, difficult schedules, maybe they can't figure out how to deal with their own anxiety and they're spewing it forth on their team. As an employee, I want to encourage you to say, I would like to talk with you sometime. This is what happened. This is how I felt. If you just do that, it goes a long way, and it takes a lot of courage, because I think intrinsically, if you don't have that power, is this person going to fire me? Is this person going to do that? They may. If they do fire you, then get out of there quickly, because that person is a very unhealthy, and at least in the American job market, there are other opportunities. However, I think if you go into that with your own sense of calm and peace, you may be able to lead up in that context. And that's hard to do, but I've been in contexts where, as you say, reactivity can move around rooms. If you sort of stop it and say, this is what's happening inside of me, this is what happened, this is how I felt, you could potentially positively influence both your boss as well as maybe your team as well.
Friends, the Being Human podcast is still relatively new. Many of you are still getting to know me, but for some of the old timers around here, back when I had the show Managing Leadership Anxiety, you relished the gauntlet. And so we've kept that for the new show. Jeff, you've heard the gauntlet, but you have not endured the gauntlet. As is often the case, doing is different than hearing about it. So here we go. Five rapid fire questions for you. Question number one, how do you know when you're not well?
When I get angry with my kids for not picking up their stuff constantly. When I'm doing well, sometimes house is clean, sometimes it's not. When I'm not doing well, everything is an annoyance, and I let everybody around me know it, and then my wife tells me.
That's very relatable. What kinds of people in the workplace, what kinds of personality traits or behaviors trigger you the most?
One is apathy. People are just checking in and checking out. It makes me feel like there's some sort of a dead soul that I want to work with. I want to help. So that's difficult. And I would also say probably even more than that would be arrogance. If somebody just comes into the room that's incredibly arrogant, thinks they're the only person with ideas, and I've been this, so I should say this, but if they're really arrogant, boy, that's very difficult. I just want to be like, I don't care how much money you have or whatever, I'm just leaving. So those two, I would say, trigger me the most.
Guaranteed, yeah. When you think about your family of origin, what might be one asset and one liability that you've inherited from your family of origin?
Asset, a love of learning. My mother was a elementary school teacher, and she passed that one right down to me. She's always learning, and I've loved learning. Liability, it's been a long journey to even know that I had emotions. We were stoic Lutherans in Minnesota. An emotion is like standing up to go when the church service is done. That's an emotion. So that was somewhat of a liability coming into marriage. I had to figure out this whole other part of me. Hmm.
All right, two more questions. I think most Christians experience a gap between what we believe versus what we experience from God. So for me, for much of my life, the gap was God's love. I believe God's love. I didn't necessarily feel it. What would be a gap in your faith?
I would echo that first, God's love. I've said that, we've all said that, but It felt like something I had to intellectually assent to for a long time. I didn't feel that deep acceptance, and it showed itself in working really hard, trying to prove my worth and my identity through my life and my work for a very long time that had some destructive consequences. So I would say that. And just really, maybe I could put it more distinctly, God likes me. That one was a hard one to receive because I oftentimes didn't. And then what is I calling God a liar or not? So,
yeah, that's a beautiful answer. So the final question is, when in your life lately have you felt most fully and completely loved?
1 year ago, I took a trip with my wife to Hawaii, and it was quiet, and we were outside, and we were together, and our schedules were slow, and we were in a beautiful place, and we just had a chance to not perform and to rest each other. I experienced God's love and my wife's love in just an amazing way over this short vacation, and it calmed me a little bit coming back afterwards.
Hmm. My guest is Jeff Hanen. Recently wrote a book and released it, Working from the Inside Out. If you find yourself in a workplace environment 40 to 60 hours a week, this is the book you want. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on Being Human.
Thanks, Steve Kess. Appreciate you.
Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Enneagram and Marriage Podcast, an outreach dedicated to bringing joy, strength, intimacy, and purpose to couples seeking growth. Be sure to visit enneagramandmarriage.com to find your chemistry together again, or for the very first time.